Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is journalist, book critic, writer, Carolyn Eden, and we're talking about her book, Cold Kitchen, A Year of Culinary Journeys. Carolyn, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
There are certain books, you know, I cover a lot of books on different areas, and a lot of it's the subject matter is important. The writing sort of takes second seat. But in this case, both of the things are really amazing. This is a book that's so wonderfully written about such fascinating stuff. I just enjoyed this book so much. It's very unique because it's about food, cooking, your kitchen especially, your travels, which are really unique. And it's also a book review of your favorite gastronomic books.
Right.
That seemed to be a huge thing for you. Do you have a big book collection at home?
I do have a big book collection at home, I have to confess. They live everywhere. I mean, a lot of cookbooks, obviously, in the kitchen, but then my sitting room, I've got a whole wall of books. And that's partly because I was a bookseller for many years in London.
Oh, that'll
so
do
I'm
it.
Always saying, I'm a bookseller first, and then kind of everything else. I just love and live books. So, yeah, in all of my books that I've written, I always try to include one or two writers who I feel should be better known, who've perhaps fallen by the wayside, because obviously so many books are published over the course of time. And there are a couple in Cold Kitchen, the memoir that I've just had published that we're discussing, that I was really pleased to get in there.
Many of the authors in the books I had never heard of before. And they all sound really interesting. I almost want you to write a book reviewing the history of gastronomic memoirs. Because, okay. Well, that would be actually helpful because it seemed like each one of them had a story. I mean, they were not the same and they did things differently. And it's always fascinating to read these stories, especially yours. Now, you have to mention your kitchen, because your kitchen is actually another character in this book.
Yes, the kitchen's definitely a central character in the book. I wasn't sure when I set out to write this, what would be the overriding sort of main character? Because we've got Darwin, my beloved beagle, in the book,
and
who's a constant companion.
Yep.
And then the kitchen itself, which when I bought this apartment, this flat, as we call them here, it's ground floor basement. The kitchen takes up the entire basement. And I knew, I'd looked at like 10 properties and I knew this is going to be the one because I thought that's where life will happen. It will happen in that basement kitchen. And it is just where life's great moments happen, I think, to so many of us and live on. And the sort of central message in the book is that I see the kitchen as a portal to other places, other people, and other times. Because I think that when we cook, we often evoke a certain sense of nostalgia for moments and places. So when I'm cooking and I'm writing recipes, because I've published several cookbooks, I'm really trying to recreate. So I have this idea about the kitchen being a portal to other lands. And then just to describe it briefly, I'm in the city centre of Edinburgh, but it's almost got quite a countryside feel, this kitchen. It's got wood beams on the ceiling. I've got a big hexagonal dining table in the centre, which always has like a floral tablecloth on it. And then there's one window that looks out to the street level. So I can sort of see dogs' tails going past, buggies with babies in. People's feet, and I can tell what the weather's doing by what people are wearing on their feet. You know, if they're wearing wellies, I know it's raining. If they're wearing sandals, obviously it's summertime. And all of this comes in through the window. So it's like Edinburgh is also very present in the book because it's coming in through my subterranean window. It's my eye out to the city.
I love those moments in the summer when the festivals are on. Because there's a lot of
raucous.
Yeah, it gets pretty rough. Now you don't have one of these state of the art kitchens either.
I mean, No, I didn't.
Have a lived-in kitchen.
Yes, the kitchen is as it was when I bought it. I mean, I'm a writer. I don't have the budget for a really super-duper kitchen, and I don't think you need one. I'm a simple home cook, so I have a stove, which I cook most of. Obviously, I have an oven. I have some, fine appliances, but it's nothing fancy. That's not the idea of it.
Well, it's really what's wonderful about the book is every section. By the way, there are four big sections which have to do with every one of the seasons. But you'll be working in the kitchen at something, and it's very cinematic. Very all of a sudden, you know, you're having a reverie. You can sort of see the cinema lines getting blurry, and you're remembering some trip that you took, and that takes up the bulk of that chapter. It's really, they could make a movie out of this book.
Well, that would be nice. My whole thing with all of my books that I've written, my first book was Samarkand, which was all about Central Asia and the Caucasus, and then I wrote a book on the Black Sea region, and then I wrote a book all about Central Asia called Red Sands. And all of those books, my sort of central message has been, you can tell any story through food. And I don't like to be restricted. I like to be able to write about whatever I'm interested in, whether it's agriculture or a particular city or perhaps someone interesting that I've met or the climate emergency, you know, some serious things and some lighthearted things. But the message is always that you can tell any story through food and that the recipes are like postcards I send to the reader.
Yep.
Because I'm just a home cook. I'm not a professional. And I'm also, I'm really a travel writer. And so when I go out to places, you know, I'm learning. I'm an outsider. I've got the outsider eye. You know, I can't claim, I never claim complete authenticity, for example, because I can't, because I'm not from those places. So it's always my interpretation and a way for the reader to taste the journey. So you read the chapter, and then at the end, if you fancy it, you can make the recipe, which I think is a nice thing.
The areas that you travel to in this book are fascinating. Several areas in Central Asia, Turkey, the Ukraine, South Caucasus, which is a place I've never been to. I've always dreamt about going to the Baltics and Poland. These are very sort of specific areas. What has attracted you to these locations?
I always say, so I guess with my bookseller hat on, back in the day, sort of 2016, I published that book. I saw a gap in the market for a food book on Central Asia. But it wasn't really just that. It's more that I like to concentrate and return to places. So I only ever write about the region between Eastern Europe and Central Asia, which is a huge swathe to be getting on with. You know, it's including Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, you know, Poland. These are very, very big countries. And by returning to these places regularly or as regularly as I can, I can see the changes that are happening on the ground. So Central Asia, for example, at the moment is having quite a tourism boom, and that really affects the place. So with my, you know, reporter's hat on, I can go back in and see what's happened and what's changed. And I also like to see how food crosses borders. I'm always very interested in the borderlands and what happens when, you know, how do people use herbs differently in Turkey to, say, Georgia? That sort of thing. Often these are very small things, and often that's not really the interesting thing, but it's a kind of hook, and it's I do believe it's useful to have, I wouldn't say expertise, because I think that's too grand, but to have an area of interest that you concentrate on, because then I think you can really develop knowledge rather than scattering yourself too far away. And obviously this region that I've been writing about now for 15 odd years has been in the news a lot in the last 3 years with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So that, unfortunately, that has been a backdrop in Cold Kitchen and in another book I've just finished, because I can't step away from it. And Black Sea, my other book, we did a new issue of that where I included an essay about the horrific incursions into Ukraine. And I went back to Ukraine last year to do some reporting as well. So it's very close to my heart.
Let's talk about one example. And this is when I read this section, which is at the beginning of the book, I knew I was in for something special. Talk about melons in Uzbekistan.
Yes.
Man, did you go melon crazy but it sounds like all of Uzbekistan is wild about melons.
Well, they kind of are. I have this saying where I say France is the land of the croissant. Uzbekistan is the land of the melon. I wrote an article for the Financial Times all about this a while ago, and it did really well. Everyone was fascinated by this because it's the winter melons specifically that Uzbekistan is very good at growing, and they hang them in these sheds. So,
okay, I'm going to ask you for a moment. There's a word, the name of the shed.
Oh, yes.
How do you pronounce
it?
What?
It's something like hohona.
Okay, it's Q-O-V-U-N-X-O-N-A?
Yes, roughly, Chochona, something similar to that. And it's a special shed for maturing melons. And it has to have like portholes so the air can flow through.
Wow.
And they'll hang the melons for a long period of time, I think depending on the particular variety. And over time, those melons become ever sweeter. They amass sucrose. So when they're selling them on the side of the road, the melon traders, in, say, autumn and towards the winter months, these melons have been ripening for a really long time, and they're very precious. They're not expensive to buy. They're like $2 or something, but they're incredible, and they're all different, and they all have different names. And these melon traders, I mean, I stopped and talked to one just outside of Samarkand, and he is there sleeping on a little metal bed frame with a mattress and a canopy until November. So I think that was September. For a couple of months, he'd be there on the side of the road to sell the melons because the demand was that great. And, they're in a melon field, these guys. It's an incredible story and really, really interesting. And these melons have been traded throughout history.
Wow.
So we might not know so much about them, but they've always been traded to China and to Russia and probably to Turkey as well, as sort of gifts of great beauty. So really interesting.
I just got, here we are in the middle of winter here in the States, and it was like, I'm reading all about these melons. They're not available right now. And I'm like, oh my God, I want that melon. Do they taste extraordinary?
Sorry, once again.
Do they taste extraordinary?
They do taste extraordinary. I mean, they're all slightly different, but I remember one just tasted kind of really honeyed, like a honey taste.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like really sort of bourbon, vanilla, honey.
Oh, stop.
An intensity that we just don't get with some of the watery melons that we import over many hundreds of miles.
Just to get, again, to sort of counter that so my mouth doesn't water anymore, you took a long railway trip on the Trans-Siberian Express to Vladivostok, the end of Russia, essentially. That sounded like one big drunken craziness.
It was a bit. And it's funny. I don't ever in the book call it the Trans-Siberian Express.
But that's what it was.
No one calls it that, though. It's everybody calls it the Express, but it's not actually known as that.
But it is it.
It's a Western thing where we all call it the Trans-Siberian Express. But it's an irony in a way because it's not an express train. It's quite slow.
Now you went. You went in winter.
Yeah, we went in winter. So we went because it's much more interesting in winter.
Oh, really?
The landscape. I mean, Siberia in winter is just everybody boards with the same idea. You get on the train and you think you're going to read Tolstoy or one of these great, ginormous Russian novels. But you sit there and you look out the window and everything is interesting. You stop at a tiny platform somewhere and there's a dog sat there and there's a woman, wearing 3-inch heels, even though there's kind of a foot of snow. And then the dachas in the distance all look like Christmas puddings because they've got like these big hats of snow on them. And then you'll sort of go past some terrible looking prison and then you'll see some men ice fishing somewhere. And I mean, it's just really interesting. And then I was in a sort of standard carriage and sleeper. And I'd have this ever-revolving set of Russians who would come in and share the cabin. And it was so interesting to talk to ordinary Russians and to find out about their lives and where they were going. And obviously they used the train just to get to college or to get to a work appointment or to visit family. For me, it was like an adventure. It was a trip I'd always wanted to do. And
it's a long trip.
Obviously, it's very bittersweet now. I don't know if I'd ever go back to Russia, but it was an amazing journey.
It was a very long trip, too, a very long train trip.
7 days with a break. I did get off and had a stop in a hotel for a night. But, yes, it's a long journey. It takes 9 hours to fly from Vladivostok back to Moscow.
What
which
I love
for me in a small country in the UK, and you're in America, which is a big country, but for me, that's just insane. It's a huge distance.
What I love about your writing is you include a lot of interesting information. When you're talking about on that trip, you were at one point you were drinking several bottles of Caucasian champagne, and you quote Alexandre Dumas as calling it epileptic cocoa?
Yeah, I mean, it was Valentine's Day when I was on the train. So Alexei and Tatiana, who became our sort of drinking friends that got on, they immediately went off to the bar and managed to get a bottle of champagne and brought it back. And we started off with that. And it wasn't bad. I mean, it's the Russians love sparkling wines and champagnes and things. So we had that. And then the vodka came out. And the thing with Russian vodka is if you're in a social setting, you have to drink to the end of the bottle.
Oh, yeah.
You don't leave it. So it was a long time. I couldn't tell you how many hours it was.
I'll just tell the listeners, there's a great description of your railway car the morning after.
Oh, yeah, it was a bit gross. And, I mean, you don't get a shower, so, yeah.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is journalist, book critic, writer, Caroline Eden. And we're talking about her new book. It is a great read. Cold Kitchen, A Year of Culinary Journeys. Well, Caroline, one of the things that comes out in this book, reading all the chapters, is you have a real passion for just wandering around foreign cities.
Yeah, I do. I'm a big walker, so I love urban walking, hill walking, you know, going up and down mountains here in Scotland. And I'm a great believer in just walking around and listening and watching and spending time. Obviously, it's a privilege to be able to do this. But I do think that that's where the stories lie and, you know, by spending time walking around great cities like Riga in Latvia, a city I really love, Istanbul, fantastic city to walk around when it's not too hot. You know, you get to know places from the ground up.
And talking about your gastronomic authors, can you talk about people like Carla Grissman, who I think she wrote Dinner of Herbs?
Yes.
And then Leslie Blanche, Round the World in 80 Dishes. Both of them, I was intrigued by what you wrote about them.
Amazing writers, very, very different. Leslie Blanche was English and extremely eccentric and loved Russia and anything to do with Russian culture and wrote several books and some quite serious books as well. She's pretty well known here in the UK. But Carla Grissman is one of the authors that I think should be much better known than she is. She's an American. And she was working at the Jerusalem Post. And then in the 60s, in the 1960s, she moved to a remote village in Turkey, in Anatolia, and lived with a family for a year and wrote this book called Dinner of Herbs, which is a wonderful book all about living in rural Turkey in the 1960s, before the advent of roads and mobile phones and all these other things. And she writes so beautifully about food and the women gathering together and the coming of spring. And it's just really transportive and wonderful snapshot of that period of time. And Eland, they're a publisher here in the UK. They sort of republished Forgotten Travel books. They published her book. So it's available. It's on Amazon and it's in some bookshops. So please do, if your listeners are interested, get a copy, because I absolutely love Carla Grissman. She's a wonderful writer.
You really put it all out there for the readers. One of the things I learned is you hate picnics, but you know how to pack for hiking.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the picnic. I always think they're
I'm pretty clear about that.
Well, I do have strong opinions about certain things. Yes, I would rather put in a rucksack certain things, and those things are normally the same. I'm quite boring. I will have some cheddar cheese, some good Scottish cheddar cheese, some oat cakes, which are like the sort of biscuits to go with the cheese. I might have a hip flask of sloe gin. And I'm definitely going to probably make my pastas, which I have a recipe for.
Oh, yeah.
In the book, the Hillside Pastas. And these are vegetarian. And the great thing with the pasty, do you know what a pasty is?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have them in America?
No, I don't. Well, I had them because I've been abroad.
Right. So I'm trying to think what to compare them to. They're like a pocket. Yep. Baked with a filling, normally with meat, but these ones that I make are with cheeses and herbs and garden greens and things like that. And we put interesting things like preserved lemon and nutmeg for flavor. And the great thing with a pasty is the contents doesn't fall out when you're walking.
That's right.
So you can be walking along and it stays there in your hand. It's a really easy, you know, good thing to have as you're going along. And often with hill walking in Scotland, you don't want to stop because the weather could be appalling, but you do need to eat so you can keep going with the pasty.
Now,
so,
on that hike in Scotland, I think it was Glen Almond, you find a cloudberry. And it's one of those, that's one of those plants that I had heard of, but I've never actually seen. And your writing about it was just entrancing.
Thank you. I mean, it's probably my favorite essay in the book. Actually, there's 12. And I love this one because we don't go very far away. And the whole point of the essay is that sometimes magic really is around the corner. And I'd always associated cloudberries with Arctic and subarctic regions. And that's where they tend to grow. And I had tried some cloudberries in a jam, and it was very, very sweet, not very nice. And I thought one day I would love to try them, you know, in nature. And I found one in Scotland.
Wow.
Out on the hill walk one afternoon. As soon as I saw it, I knew what it was.
Are they, they're
the
sort of
it,
reddish or pink?
Yeah, they're kind of like a very, very deep amber orange. Mm-hmm. And very few, you know, like with raspberries, you get lots of little pockets of juice. Mm-hmm. These cloudberries only have 3 or 4. So they look they're quite distinctive looking. And I knew as soon as I saw it what it was. And obviously a bird had dropped the seed. They do grow in Scotland, but they're very, very, very rare in the UK. So it was an amazing thing to find this cloudberry. And I debated in the book where I write about debating whether to have eaten it or not, and I do, because I thought if it's not me, it's going to be another creature which perhaps won't appreciate it to the same degree. So I do sit down and eat the cloudberry, but I took a photo of it first.
So what's the taste like?
Quite sharp. But it was sort of a bit peachy tasting, and a sort of tart, bit like a lime, but with peach, full-bodied.
Mm.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, obviously, it was an emotional experience finding one, because I'd wanted to try one for so many years, and finding one close to home was really incredible. But yeah, really amazing. I cherished that moment so much.
I also, like we were talking about how personal this is, that you really didn't like Hitchcock in To Catch a Thief having the cigarette stubbed out in an egg.
Mm.
'Cause you called it that foul scene.
It is a pretty horrible image, isn't it? If you imagine a fried egg.
It just sort of seemed like I could just imagine you saying that foul scene.
It's
and you write
horrible,
that Hitchcock hated eggs.
He apparently hated eggs. I don't know much about him, but I do know that he hated eggs, and that sort of a cigarette being stubbed out in the yolk of a fried egg, I think it's a bit stomach churning, and that is in a difficult essay about Poland and war,
right?
And
yeah.
How sometimes things we see can turn our stomachs. So it's just for a bit of context, I guess that might all sound a bit strange, but yeah.
Do you read while you cook?
Say that again, sorry.
Do you read while you cook?
Oh, yes, I write in the book about how sometimes I have a book open while I'm reading, but it has to be like poetry or something I can read snippets of. Generally, I have the radio on, to be honest, but
okay.
I like Carla Grissman, you see, because her writing is so lyrical that you can just read a couple of paragraphs, and I find that quite fulfilling. So I think, yeah, having a book sometimes on the stove as you're working can be quite nice, but that's not always practical for people, I know.
I also learned that what the difference is between har and Scotch mist.
Mmm, the har. Very exciting when the har rolls into Edinburgh. So
it's not just fog.
No, and it's quite similar. But it comes in, and it often comes in when it's sort of been humid, but it's cold at the same time. So it's a sort of murky mist that rolls in. And if any of your listeners have been to Edinburgh and have been to, say, the Old Town, which is very, very old, and you've got these lots of cobbled lanes and very tight alleyways, it's incredibly atmospheric when the har comes in and hangs over this. So there's an essay where I'm writing about Armenia, actually, but yep. it's the morning after a dinner party, I think, and the Har have come into Edinburgh and sort of laid like a breath, this North Sea mist over the city, and I take Darwin, my beagle, out in it, and it's so sick. It was, the city looked like a black and white movie, almost, kind of amazing.
It's fascinating because there's some very serious reporting / writing in this book, too, especially when you're in Kyrgyzstan, in Bishkek.
Yeah.
That, within the context of the book, that really seems to come out of nowhere. And did you find yourself then switching to the role of a reporter at that point?
Well, I did. I had to write about this because it was such a remarkable experience which happened to me. There was almost like a coup that occurred when I was in Bishkek around the time of the pandemic, so not very long ago. And I was out there to try and improve my terrible childish Russian with a teacher. And this uprising happened very, very quickly. And they've had several revolutions in Kyrgyzstan before. Kyrgyzstan's a country in Central Asia. And it was just complete chaos.
Wow.
That overnight it happened. And unfortunately, because it's around the time of the pandemic, I know quite a lot of the journalists in that region, there wasn't anyone there.
I know.
The BBC were in touch with me, and because I've done some news reporting, and they said, can you come on and do some reporting?
It's an amazing section of the book. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end here, Caroline, because we're completely out of time. But we don't want to describe everything in the book. Anyways, people need to buy it and read it. I'm that crass.
That would be nice.
My guest tonight has been journalist, book critic, writer, Caroline Eden. And we've been talking about her book, Cold Kitchen, A Year of Culinary Journeys. Caroline, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.